This is the Teachable Soul Podcast. Because we cannot possibly live long enough to make all the mistakes ourselves, let's take a few moments to learn from the mistakes of others. The Teachable Soul Podcast, where guests and listeners like you share stories of failure and teachable moments on the journey to success. Here's your host, Kat Daniels.
Welcome to the Teachable Soul Podcast. I am your host, Kat Daniels, and today with me, I have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Russell Nolte. Is that pronounced correctly?
It's Nolte, but it's okay.
Nolte. Sorry, I should have checked before. But Russell has been obsessed with failure since he started his business, The Wannabe Press, which was his fifth business. The first three went bankrupt and the fourth blew up in his face 6 months into the company. He has now raised over $170,000 on Kickstarter, built a mailing list of over 25,000 people, and tabled at more than 150 events since 2016. Obviously, that probably doesn't include 2020. But he also teaches creatives how to lead a complete and successful life through his teaching academy and podcast, The Complete Creative, which you can check out at thecompletecreative.com. Welcome, Russell. Thank you for coming today and sharing your stories with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I can't wait.
I know, me too. So let's dive right in. What do you want to, I have so many questions, but I honestly don't know where to start. So do you want to start with your first few companies that kind of blew up in your face and went bankrupt and kind of everything that happened along the way? There?
Sure. So it's really interesting because every time I do one of these podcasts, I learn a little bit more about my own story as I'm telling different stories. And like every podcast is a different thing. So I was just talking with somebody maybe 15, 20 minutes before we got on the air about kind of focus and what it really takes to lead a creative life. And I feel like there's two pieces of it. So we don't talk about the first one a lot. The second part is sort of like monetizing and like becoming a professional and getting jobs and, you know, all of the things we talk about in this. But the first part of it is equally as important and probably takes even longer than the second part is, it is really having a safe space to fail where you can try things and experiment and sort of find new influences and sort of remix all of the things that you know into sort of your own special sauce. So like with Wannabe Press Books, a lot of that came from my love of sort of funny horror movies, like B-horror movies, fantasy, thriller, science fiction. And I like the way that I was able to sort of mesh together things like the Godsverse or Katrina Hates the Dead and blend it with sort of mythology and fairy tales and all of the things I love came from the ability to sort of play and also take things to their logical conclusions. So for instance, I used to be a fashion photographer. I was mediocre at it at best because I didn't spend the time to really grow myself as I didn't care enough to spend the time necessary to grow into the full realization of like being a photographer. Like I just was not technical enough for one, did not geek out about gear enough. I was just not searching for all of the things to make to have success as a photographer. I also did this as a blogger and run like directing film and just all of these things. It wasn't until I really started being a writer and taking writing and comics and novels seriously that I started really having like success. And so those first companies, I had a photography studio. We already talked about how like I would shoot movies and I got sent to Denmark on a movie and I have a ton of great stories, but just like I wasn't very good. It wasn't very good. And like I didn't care to take the time necessary to like become great at it. Yeah. But it was good because now I do film and TV. And now I'm a writer and I can see visually and I can design graphics very well. And all of that stuff sort of has come back. Like I used to work in news. Like I hated news.
Oh man.
I was good enough at it that like I got jobs at it. But again, I just was not willing to take those skills and like amplify them to the part where I would be like a reporter for like a good like a top 20 station or something like that. I just didn't have that passion, but I was able to take all of that stuff and like now I can interview other people on my podcast and I can do all of that other stuff that I like that I didn't feel good enough to make it my main source of income, but like it has influenced the thing that I had. And so I directed a film which is quite mediocre and some short stuff, and like I all of that sort of first 20s I feel like was so formative for me because I failed a lot. But I also gave myself the ability to, until I hit 30, basically screw up and like just take whatever kinds of risks that I wanted to take, whatever kind of direction that I wanted to take, assuming I was making money. So like I also was an executive producer at an internet television network. I shot news for Capitol Hill, and you know, I got hired to direct a reality show pilot. So it's not like I was without any success in my 20s, but it certainly was not any to the level that I have now or for my own work. So yes, I had three companies that sort of failed in my 20s, and it taught me that like that was not the right path. Like I didn't know sales and marketing enough, and to be like I wasn't that guy. And then I knew I wasn't that guy because like just nothing would resonate. Like not with me, but when other people would see my work, just like they were like, oh, it's good. It's fine. Like nothing wrong with that. Like it's technically proficient. Like it's cool. But there wasn't that like, oh my God. And it wasn't until I started Wannabe Press and started showing like Ichabod Jones Monster Hunter or Katrina Hates the Dead, the first book in our sort of Godsverse Chronicles universe, that I started noticing that people were changed by the work that I had done now. And so that all of that previous stuff before I hit about 32 was sort of this play. I mean, I wasted a lot of money playing. I had like $100,000 playing. So right. I didn't know this before. I would have like done probably things quite a bit differently had I known that like this was the area. Mm-hmm. But I was searching for the thing that I would be able to drill down on and like really focus on enough to like have success at it. And I would be obsessed enough to like read every book and like write every day and do all of the stuff necessary to have success. And it wasn't until I started seeing how I treated my writing compared to how I treated everything else in my life that came before it, and how other people treated me about my writing, that I really noticed the difference. And it's one of those things you can look back on and see immediately once you understand what you're looking for. But in it, it kind of is hard to tell what like is going on when you're not having that success.
Yeah, exactly. So were you writing the entire time as well, or did you just decide one day to start writing along the way?
So, right, I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a director or a cameraman or something else when it came to film. But what would happen was I would be on these sets and the scripts would be just God awful. It'd be so bad. And I would say to myself, like, well, I mean, I don't know if I can do like a good job, but I can definitely do better than this. Right. And if this is all it takes to like direct a movie is to say you're a director and like write a script, like I can write a script. I know I have people that can help me like put all the pieces together and like hire and like I can hire well. Mm-hmm. And like then I could make something and at least I would have made it. And it'll be mine. It won't be someone else's. And that sort of followed me through my whole life, frankly. Like for instance, I made that movie, Connections, and it's actually a pretty good web series. It was not a good movie, but like we cut it and made it a web series. I'm like, it's pretty good as far as web series goes. Right. And but then like when I started writing and getting success as a writer, I got some publishing deals. And the publishing deals, they were awful. Like they weren't doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, like, I could probably publish my work at least as well as this. Like if the barometer is screwing up releasing my books, like I can screw up releasing my own books. And so like then I did it. But then by doing, I like learned like how to do it really well. And I learned from all of the things that I hated about other productions or other publishers or other things, like how to build something better. So I started writing as a means to an end to direct. And then I got into a pretty bad car accident in 2008, January. And I was in a neck brace. I couldn't do anything. Like that's when I lost my photography company. I lost another product because I just couldn't do anything. And so all I could do was write. And I started to realize that like the writing process was the only thing that I really had control over. It was the only person that like could dictate something by themselves. Like all it took was me and a piece of paper. And that was power to me. when as a filmmaker, you don't have that power. You're always relying on somebody else to say yes, something else to say yes, or some location to follow through or something. There's all these things that dictate what you're going to do. But as a writer, you have control. And when you're writing novels, you really have all the control to make the thing you want. And I really like control. It's even now, you know, when the world feels like it's out of control, when I can just go back into a story that I can manipulate in the way that I want it, I suddenly have this like sense of clarity and peace that I don't have anywhere else.
Right. And yeah, I mean, I agree. I love having control over my life, but I've obviously, you know, after the car wreck, especially, I'm sure that we can't always have control. But I can understand where in writing you kind of can. I mean, you're right. So your Kickstarter that you did, was that for your writing projects?
Yeah, I've done now. I'm in the middle of my 12th campaign right now. And all 11 previous ones have been either for anthologies that I've edited, comic books that I've created, or novels that I've written. Except for one, which was a kid's book that I published. But since I usually don't publish other people's work except in my anthologies, now I don't really do that. So like out of 12, 11 of them have been for my own work or work that my publishing company has worked on extensively.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's cool. So how did you get started on Kickstarter? Did you just like do it and it was successful initially?
comics is the thing that I started working on. The first thing that I really like fell in love with enough to like become obsessed. And I think that's really like eventually if you're doing enough creative work and trying enough different things, you will eventually find the thing that like you become obsessed and you just can't stop thinking about that one thing. And sometimes that changes over time. But for me, it was comics. And now it's sort of comics and novels. But comics is that first thing. And when you're there's a way to make money in every industry. And the way to make money in comics is to go to Kickstarter and fund your book and then go to shows and sell your book. That was just like the way that you did it. It's sort of like, you know, drop shippers would have to know Amazon. I had to know Kickstarter. When I launched my first book on Kickstarter, Ichabod Jones Monster Hunter, and it made like $5,500 in a month. Like I was blown away because I mean, I'm not exactly sure how much money that any of my previous companies had made, but like collectively, they did not seem to do. Like, I never made $5,000 in 1 month doing anything ever. So watching that happen, it kind of became like an addiction to me. And that $5,500 I did the next time, it became $8,700. But more importantly, like I didn't realize how important this was until later. But like you got the emails, like you actually could talk to the people who bought the book, like not like in an ethereal way, like you literally could talk to them. You could message them. You could email them. You could make it so they became an integral part of your business.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't get that from Amazon. I did not realize that because like Amazon, while my books are on Amazon, like they. It has never been a big part of my business. And in fact, it wasn't until like all of the shows got canceled basically for this year that I looked at my wife and was like, oh, I guess I got to like focus on Amazon now or like getting online sales up. And I was like, I kind of know how to do that. But like I've never like done that thing before in my career. So it was odd to like have to now to watch books launch and to like not know who bought it or who didn't buy it or why they didn't buy it or why they did buy it. And so then I went back to Kickstarter pretty hardcore. I did only one campaign last year and one the year before, but I'm doing four this year. And part of that is because like you get to interact immediately with the people who buy your work. And it just, it's beautiful. Like it's a beautiful thing that you like, that's who I'm writing for. And now I can see when they're actually buying my work. And then I can put it on Amazon after that and do all of the things that Amazon has to do. But now I'm actually making a connection with like the most important people who are like sort of the rabid fans who are paying top dollar for my work. Mm-hmm. Whereas most people in other places are like want the book for 99 cents or like they're going to buy it when it goes on discount or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things, that's one of the issues that I have with podcasting is, you know, like when you have a YouTube channel, people can comment on there and you can actually like interact with them. But when you have a podcast or whenever you're doing a podcast, they can't even comment. It's just reviews is the only access that you have really. Yeah. And I know that you have your own podcast as well, The Complete Creative. And I'm actually considering switching over to YouTube just so that I can interact and, of course, also have better analytics. Like, I love podcasting. I love having a podcast, but there's still so many ways that I'm restricted. And I hate to be restricted because, again, control. But that's, yeah, I mean, I agree. Interacting with your because they're kind of their customers and their clients and they're all those things, but you kind of also, when you're in a creative space, I think you want to be closer to the people that you interact with, right?
Yeah. So this is like, this is a weird thing about creators where like the money's not the factor for them.
No, yeah.
You know, like for instance, I make good money writing, but like I would make way more money doing literally anything else because like writing is a very poor business model. Like they're expensive to make. They're very time intensive. There's a race to the bottom as far as pricing goes. Like there's millions of books and there's tons of them for free. Like if you go to a business class and you told them you wanted to be a publisher, they would say that is a terrible business idea.
Exactly.
But I like people are not driven by that. Generally what they're driven by is the ability, the desire to find more people and create their own fandom and like have more people touched by the thing that they do. So I always say that money is the ancillary byproduct of the way that I run my business. And I think that's true. Like I want to find more people. Like we add about 10,000 people a month to my mailing list. And like, that's how we sort of keep growing and keep sort of the process that I have going. But the money then flows from that ability, not the purpose of that ability is the money. The purpose of it is to like have people read my work and enjoy it. And then things like, because they have to buy it to read it and enjoy it, then there's money that comes out of that. And it's a weird kind of thing for creativity. And I mean, on one hand, I love podcasting because like there is this sort of like beautifully decentralized, like, mess that is podcasting. But on the other hand, I do agree with you. Like I would like to have the ability to get comments or know who actually is listening. And that's why I have the podcast on our website, but I also make sure to do a content maximizer every episode, which is, you know, a way for people to learn more by either downloading a PDF or a course or something, then I also have on my teaching academy a way for them to get all of the interviews for free, all of the interviews I've ever done without any ads or anything. So I cut out all the ads and I just put them on for the first 150 when I started having too many that like my podcast server doesn't show all of them. I started putting them on that so they can go and get them. So it's not a perfect system because, you know, maybe 5 to 10% of people have utilize that part of it, but at least it does help to see like who I'm actually helping and which content maximizers are doing the best.
Yeah. So you're kind of doing like your own Patreon just on your own website because you're already hosting and things like that, basically.
Yeah. Right? I mean, most of it. So I do have courses. So the way that I make money on my podcast is I don't have sponsors. I don't have ads. What I do is the training academy has courses and some of them are quite expensive, $500 or more. Some of them are free. Some of them are, you know, between $1 and $200, depending on what the course is. And that is how I make money on the podcast. And the podcast is an ancillary part of, but a very important part of the overall Complete Creative brand.
Right. Of course. Yeah. And I think that that's something that a lot of creatives are going towards is the courses, because it's something that they can always have on hand, basically, and make money with that way.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I had a podcast called The Business of Art. And the reason that folded was because there was no way to monetize it. honest, like after 150 episodes, I just got burnt out. I felt like I wasn't growing anymore as a podcaster. The podcast was about how to break in as an artist or writer or creative. And I just like felt like I had nothing to add to that conversation anymore after doing 150 episodes and having broken in. You know, I wanted to talk about something else, but I didn't know what that was. So I wanted to make sure when I brought the podcast back, it would be around this training academy idea where like there would be monetization built in. And then I could spend on marketing to grow that user base of people who were listening to the show, because there was that money at the end of the line where people could, where I could then say, okay, if I spend $500 on marketing, I'm at least going to make this $500 back.
Right. Exactly. Which is important. And you had that knowledge because you had, you know, dealt with and failed in businesses before. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing that like failure teaches you. I think people are, like, failure is hard. Don't get me wrong. And like, please don't go and drop $100,000 on failed businesses like I did. One thing failure does is it like it guides you to the light. Like nothing guides you to where you're supposed to do, like something blowing up in your face and being like, oh, well, right. I'm not ready for that. Or like, that's not the right path for me. And this has happened so many times in my life where I've like started down a path only to have it blow up in my face or to realize that I didn't like it enough to like care enough to go from 20 to 40 to 80 to 100, whatever that thing is, you know, whatever that drive forward. And I think that, you know, young people are often sort of criticized for their flakiness, right? Like, oh, she never knows what she's going to do, or like she's always quitting jobs. And I think that's the point. Like, that's the point of being young, is you don't know what you want to do. And I try to never forget that, you know, I had 100 jobs when I was younger, like thinking that I was really like this thing, but like not liking it, or thinking I finally got to direct a movie. And then when I did it, I like, it still took 6 years to edit, because like I just wasn't into the end process. And then I moved out here, and then writing became the focus. And I kept moving my focus because I wasn't sure. But then once I got sure, my focus has kind of stayed. Since 2010, I've been a writer, and an unsuccessful one that led to a pretty successful one, but a writer nonetheless.
Right. Well, and that's how I think all successful journeys start out, is you have to start somewhere anyways. So you start out unsuccessful. Everybody starts, you know, unsuccessful, unless, of course, you have like an immense amount of help along the way, which I'm sure that you had help along the way as well. But some have more than others. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I had a ton of help. I mean, you know, in fact, my wife is probably the one who's helped my career more than me, because every time I'm like, I should just go get a job, she's like, you would hate a job and I would hate you having a job. So just like figure out this other thing, because like you've tried the job thing and it has not worked for you anytime you've done it. And she's right. You know, the longest I've ever had a job is 2 years. The longest I've had my company is 5 years. I had another company for 4 years before that, or maybe 6 years. So, I mean, I've had my companies much more than I've ever had a job.
Right.
So I believe in that giving yourself a safe space to fail mantra, and being able to take all of the time that you need within reason. And as long as you're moving forward, again, like, you know, I would get jobs in the field that I had, and then I would lose those jobs. Like after a year, I got in a car accident, or like, you know, there were indicators that like I was on the right track. Right. I think that like you need to be able to try all of that stuff, because it's only all of that stuff amalgamated back into you that makes you have a unique voice and makes people want to go to you. You know, we talked about the Godsverse Chronicles before. You know, that is all, it's just my biggest novel series, and it is mythology, which I love, and magic and monsters and thriller. You know, they're all like paced within like an inch of their life. They're all like very, very fast pace. They all have like a very terse prose so that you can get into the action and follow the action along. They all are like based sort of like the movie in your head. I'm trying to create, give you the ability to like make a movie in your head. And, you know, the photography, the visuals of the photography, and all of that, those things that I like love about what I have done in my past are all amalgamated into the Godsverse Chronicles, which is what makes them unique, which makes people think about them, and what makes people refer them is like, what is the special sauce that makes Russell's books Russell? Well, it's only come from the thousand other things that I've done in my career. And the same thing with The Complete Creative. You know, I've had a blog since 2006, and having and the vulnerability and all of the things and doing 100 courses and interviewing a bunch of people, all of that stuff is sort of the pieces that amalgamate into how I teach and how it's different from everybody else. But again, all of that stuff came from the failure as much as it did the successes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you, which is why I started this podcast, of course, because I realized that failing is kind of how we get to the successes. Like, you can't just, you know, be born and come out succeeding your whole life, because you don't, I feel like you don't learn as much if you're not failing along the way to some degree. So you mentioned that you kind of had indicators that you were on the right track along the way. So what were those indicators for you during those times?
Sure. So the first one, I got hired to do a movie in Denmark. And so I flew to Denmark for a month to like shoot this movie. I was the second unit camera, and then I brought all the gear and I was like the assistant camera. And so, you know, that was a pretty big deal. Like, that was like a pretty big package that I got. I got a job as an executive producer on an internet television network. I was able to finish production on a movie and keep it under budget. So those were a couple of the ones that I had done. Like, I had written a script that was good enough to get produced that like people actually got behind. And like, I was able to see that to fruition. So I could always be like, well, I made this movie. Like, my work can't be so bad because these people like came out and like I made a movie with them. Then, you know, when I came to LA, I got a manager almost immediately. And I was like, okay, well, like, this person is enough to believe in my work enough to like work for it. And the only time he gets paid is if I get paid. Right. And then, you know, I got a couple of scripts optioned, very small options, but like, you know, like I got enough to have a production company like get behind it first for free. And then a couple of production companies started paying me. So it's like, well, there's like something there. And then the big one was I did the Kickstarter. And like 160 something people, I raised $5,500 or something from them. And I was like, oh, well, like, that's good. And then the next time I did it, I raised more, which meant like, you know, I was doing something right. Like, I people had now read it and wanted to see more things from me. And then, you know, the big one was we did this anthology called Monsters and Other Scary Shit, and that one raised like $27,000. And the next one raised $25,000. And the next one raised $40,000. And so, like, even now, so, you know, you talked about failure and needing failure to succeed. But I mean, I have always found failure and success happen almost simultaneously. Well, as you're succeeding in one part of your life, you're failing in another. And there's some sort of, for instance, my father died a couple of years ago, and his funeral was on the same day as my most successful Kickstarter launch at the time that finished. So like, it was literally like I was giving a eulogy while this Kickstarter was ending. And there's all sorts of things that are happening, that happened. I had this really great launch, and then I had like five really horrible launches right after it, and then a great launch after that. And, you know, you're going through, I've gone through like massive bouts of depression while I'm having some of my biggest success ever. You know, some things are blowing up as they're like, so there's all these things that you almost can't have success without testing a bunch of stuff. And if you want to grow your company, you have to be trying a whole bunch of stuff. Like, I am, you know, The Complete Creative, while it does well, is like not anywhere near where it needs to be currently. And I just about 2 weeks ago lost all of our clients because of this pandemic, maybe a month ago. Wannabe Press was posed to have its best year ever. I was posed to have my best year ever. And then the coronavirus took all of my shows, you know, 20, 30 shows I was going to do this year. And now I'm doing zero. And The Complete Creative, I used to have about 100 or 200 clients. I have zero. And so literally about 80% of my business left in 2 weeks. Meanwhile, you know, I had just had a campaign that raised $30,000, and I'm doing one right now that's, you know, not going to do nearly as well, but it'll certainly raise $5,000 or $10,000 by the time it's over. It's raised about $4,500 now in 2 days. And so while I'm doing this like $30,000 launch, I literally was watching show after show after show after show get canceled and being like, well, there's $9,000, there's $20,000, there's $30,000 just gone from my budget. And then I was watching all of my clients being like, I've got to cancel, 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 I've got to cancel. And so I'm like, oh, there's, you know, $80,000, $90,000 that I was going to make this year gone. Meanwhile, I'm literally having the second best launch of my entire career.
That's super crazy. And yeah, you said earlier too, that like your jobs or your businesses lasted longer than your jobs did. And that reminded me that I listened to Gary Vee a lot, Vaynerchuk. And he said something one time that was like, an actual entrepreneur can't ever really stay in a job. And I feel like I resonate with that a lot because I've always had jobs where they never lasted long either. And you basically described the exact same thing where you can stay in a job. Like we can do things. It's just, if you're not passionate about it, it's hard to wake up every day and continue to do for an exorbitant amount of time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think some jobs you can be more entrepreneurial than others. And so there are some people that I know, like my father was the kind of person who was very entrepreneurial in his job in the federal government. And when I mean entrepreneurial, it's, you know, he found ways to bring his entrepreneurial spirit into his job. You know, he would take on new accounts, or he would take on new clients, or he would take on new things that filled his, he didn't like his job, but like he enjoyed, you know, figuring certain stuff out. And that allowed him to like at least scratch that entrepreneurial itch. But most jobs don't have that. Like most jobs just want you to be a cog in a machine. And I think that most of us who are entrepreneurs see how, like, it's important for us to have jobs because then you see just how like low the bar is.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about this all of the time where it's like you would be shocked at how low the bar is. Not you specifically, but almost everybody would be. If you actually looked at like what the bar is and what people can't even meet, like, you know, a gardener who is supposed to show up on Tuesday and doesn't show up for 2 weeks after that, which like, okay, like it's not like rocket science, but like you make an appointment with someone, you show up to that appointment. Like that is a, and then you do the job that you are like, told to do, or a delivery service that takes like hours to get somewhere and it like shows up cold, or, you know, a taxi service that like the place that the car is disgusting, or like the trunk is full of like garbage when you like go get in the car. There are all these examples of like, wow, this thing is like, you're able to like do this. You know, for instance, I was in beta on a project for a company for a year, and I was like, I can't go and tell these people to like use our service when like we've literally been in beta as long as I've been working with this company. And they're like, but we need more content. And I'm like, well, yeah, like I agree. Like you need to get out of beta. And like every day, like while when we started, this might've looked new and innovative. 2 years later, it looks like old because like you now haven't launched when you had the opportunity to launch. And I think that some people are very good about being in court. Like my wife is just like corporate to the bone. She like loves her company. She like, she defends them. She understands all of the policies. She loves that part. And she loves that they take care of all of the other stuff. So like, I don't know. I don't know if she loves everything about her company, but like she feels safe that like they trust her, that like they're going to fight for her and let her just do her work. And for me as an entrepreneur, like I've never trusted that because I've seen the inner workings of enough companies to be like, oh God, like they're just gutting this thing like for parts. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I don't have that same amount of loyalty because I believe that like a company is going to fire you the literal first minute that they can. Like if you give them a reason to fire you, they will fire you because it will cut their costs, even if it hurts them in the long run. Because I also have been a manager for long enough to know like no job is safe. But I also know that like as an entrepreneur, I get to sort of, I don't have to do what a big company does. So there's this great interview with Jim Croce, who's talking about creativity. And he said, you know, back when, now, I mean, he's a older white dude who worked in folk music. So like, take this for a grain of salt, based upon like what folk music was at the time and the people that were involved and that were not allowed to be involved. But he basically said when he started, the people who ran the companies were sort of these like crusty old white dudes. They had no idea what like good music was. And so what they would say would be like, I don't know, man, like, let's just try it. Let's just try it and see like if it works. Yeah. And as time went on, those people would then hire these like hip A&R guys who were supposed to know what people wanted. And those people then were saying like, oh, we can't put this out because people don't like it. But the whole reason behind these companies at the beginning and why they were successful would because they would just be like, I don't know, man, like maybe this will work.
Let's just see what happens.
Right.
Yeah.
And I got sick of people telling me that it wouldn't work enough times that I was like, I don't know, like who needs to take a risk on this? Is it me? Because like, I believe in this work that I'm doing. I believe that like some people, maybe not enough people for you to make profitable, but enough people for me to make profitable, believe in this thing and they want this thing. And so I had a book, my first book, Ichabod Jones Monster Hunter, was rejected by every company. They were like, we don't think this will sell. And I was like, that's ridiculous. Because like at the time it was 28 or 29. And I was like, I'm a 28-year-old white man in America. Like literally marketing is made for me. Like I am the middle of the freaking bell curve. Like, and you're telling me that like there's not a market for this, but I am telling you, like, I am the literal market that you're aiming for. And I want this book. And I'm betting that more people do than just me. And they were like, well, no. And I was like, all right, man, like I'll just do it then. I'll just do it. And like, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. And like the worst case scenario is like it'll royally blow up in my face. And I've been at the bottom before. I've been way below the bottom before. And it's just not that bad.
Right. It's not. I mean, especially for like white males in America, you know.
Yeah, it's just like I've eaten so much crow in my life. But the biggest successes that I've ever had were when I was like, I don't know, man. Let's see. And I had this book called Monsters and Other Scary Shit. And the cover is just dozens of monsters with yellow glowing eyes. It has no title, it has nothing. And every publisher I talked to, I was publishing it myself, but I was getting opinions. And every publisher friend of mine was like, this will never work. Like, there's no title on it. I don't know what to do with it. Like, what the hell is happening? And like, it went on to literally outsell all of my other books combined on Kickstarter at the time that it launched. And I did a book called Pixie Dust, which is done in this animation style, but it's like violent animation style. And people were like, can't do that. And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, let's try it. And do I regret like that it's a little too violent to be all ages? Yeah, I kind of like regret that. But like, it still raised $25,000. It still went on to spark the Godsverse, to be like the second spark in the Godsverse Chronicles. The fourth book and the third book in the series is based on Octa's stories. You know, we've sold 1,000+ copies. It's like, I'm okay taking chances because I keep my company very small. And I keep my company very small, and I like literally do most of everything myself. And then I hire out freelancers for very little because I want to be able to say, screw it. Let's just try it and see what happens. And the worst thing that happens is like, I screw myself up. But like, I have enough buffer built in. I have enough runway built in that like, if I truly screw up, like I have some time to recover from it also. And I have enough big projects that have been successful that are like good sellers for us that like, I can always fall back on that if I have to.
Right. I couldn't. It drives me a little bit crazy because I actually have a business degree, but when I graduated, I did not want to go to work for a large corporation because it drives me so crazy that larger corporations are so boxed in and they'll only go by all the things that they've done that have worked forevermore, you know, which is cool. I'm all about data and like doing things that have science and reasons behind them, but they're so limiting to me at the same time. And that bothers me when companies do that, because then I was just talking on one of my other podcasts yesterday about Waffle House and how Waffle House has stayed the same consistently for I don't even know how long, probably since they've opened, but they've never changed anything that they've ever done ever. I don't think that I'm aware of anyway. And they're getting outsold by like IHOP and larger corporations like that because they've never changed anything.
Well, there's two things about that. The first is I believe a company should be able to stay the size that they want if they're happy doing the thing. Like if they're just like, hey, I'm happy being Waffle House and like doing the thing and like we make enough money doing this thing to like make it work. Awesome. Cool. Like that's absolutely, like I think that scale is one of the biggest detrimental words in entrepreneurship or in business because some companies just shouldn't scale. And some shouldn't scale, don't want to scale above an amount. And we tend to be like, oh, well, they're stupid. They're being outsold by Waffle, by IHOP. And like, if they just change things, it's like maybe that company just wants to be Waffle House. And like, maybe they make enough profit being Waffle House that they just can, the owners can do whatever they want. And like, they don't need more money. But I had a second part of that, which is absolutely, you're right. Because like, I would never want to work for Waffle House because like they're doing the exact same thing every year. And like, it's predictable. The problem right. with a big company, and especially if they don't have an R&D team, mm-hmm. is that because their data is locked, they're running the same experiments over and over and over again. And then they'll say, well, we can't sell this other thing. But they don't mm-hmm. know if they can sell it. Or what they're saying when they're saying it won't sell is, I don't know how to sell it. So
yeah.
you have this like insular group that does the thing that they do. And you can see that in like how Blockbuster didn't buy Netflix and Yahoo didn't buy Google and all of these things.
Exactly.
The beauty of a corporation is like they know what they're doing. They're like bacon and eggs things, like steak and eggs. They know exactly what they're doing and how to like grow that thing. And like it's predictable, which for an entrepreneur, having a predictable source of income is something I've never been able to figure out. Like I have like 50 different things and like they all seem to make right. different money at different times. Mm-hmm. But they will always say, we can't do that. But like the data doesn't show that it can work because they don't test it. And the beauty about mm-hmm. entrepreneurship is you can prove it. You can prove the mm-hmm. data will work. You have to take the risk on doing that. But if it works, you can be like, no, here's a data point. I'll give you an example as we wind down is I've been talking about creative entrepreneurship since 2010. That's a long time to be talking about a subject. And I can tell you for 8 years of that, literally, I got laughed out of every room that I was in. Like treating mm-hmm. your art like a business and like becoming, you know, an entrepreneur and like having entrepreneurial spirit and having like foundational principles in your creativity to be a business. Like laughed out of every room for 8 years. Until I started having right. success. And then somehow all of these programs on like entrepreneurship and creative entrepreneurship and stuff like started popping up. And like, I'm not saying that I did it. What right, I am no. saying is that suddenly there were data points as we moved into a more gig economy of like certain things needing to be taught and certain things needing to be done. And then the industry kind of coalesced around those ideas. But it took people, not just me, but Corey Huff and others to talk about creative entrepreneurship successfully and prove that, you know, what no college would talk about, which was the business part of art.
Right.
And that is the beauty of entrepreneurship. There's no reason to go into entrepreneurship to do the same thing. You have to kind of have that unknown, which is where failure, to go back to your original point, comes in. You have to be willing to fail because the thing that you're doing is by definition a thing that has never been done before. If it's been done before, people will say, well, I'm just going to go to Kmart and get it.
Exactly. And yeah, I love doing things that have never been done before. And I think that more people should take risks to do things that have never been done before because that's how we become and innovative people to begin with. There are so many people that I have met that are so quick to be like, oh, that won't work because it's never been done before. And I'm like, but what if that's why it could work?
Right.
Because in some cases, that's the case, like with, you know, your book that doesn't even have a title on the front of it, you know, that could be the reason why it does work.
Absolutely. And like, look, I run things that are more successful and less successful. If you go and look at my summer slate on Kickstarter now, you will see it's like, clearly the least successful launch I will have had in since 2016, probably. And mm-hmm. you know, not everything is going to work when you're an entrepreneur, but like you have to keep pinging the waters and failing and being willing to fail. Otherwise, there's no reason. And you can also bring this into a corporation. So one thing that I like to talk to people who like want the corporate job is to be like, hey, talk to your boss about a thing you'd like to try and just like ask them for $500. Just be like, hey, I'm going to do this on my own time, but like, I just want a budget of like $500. Like, just approve an expense account item of $500. I will pay it. Mm-hmm. But like, I just want to test this out. I think it has merit and it's something that can help you. And if you really care about it, be like, you can, if it doesn't work, you can take that money out of my paycheck. But whatever it is, like, you can sort of bring this entrepreneurial spirit into a corporation. I know that's like, like the thing that I said is not exactly how every corporation works, but there is always a way to be like, do you trust me? If you trust me, then I'm telling you, I live in this community and it could really use this thing. All we have to do is change our messaging a little bit and it can work. The same product that we've been talking about, this thing, we just need to move it over here. And like, I'd love it if you'd let me try.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I love that. I've never thought about doing that in a corporation. That's a very good idea.
Yeah, and the thing for all entrepreneurship, or like the thing that I try to invest in everyone, is you have to be okay with some amount of failure, because the only growth only happens in failure. And whether that is like trying out for your softball team or like going to a dating mixer or like all of that stuff, the only way to grow is to fail a lot of times. My friend said, I don't know why every time I try something, I fail. I wrote back to him and said, because that is the literal point of trying things. Like, if you knew what you were doing, you still might fail sometimes. Like, I know what I'm doing, and a lot of times I'll launch products and they do not work. You know, I launched a Facebook ads course a couple of years ago because people kept asking me about Facebook ads. And I think I've sold like 3 copies of this Facebook ads course. Like the whole, maybe not even that. Maybe I've sold 1 copy. And I'm like, Jesus, like, that is awful. But now I can be like, well, what if I took that and bundled it together with a bunch of my better selling courses? And maybe I could make that a value add. Like, I add on Kickstarter, have bundles of like a bunch of my old back catalog books, which are not great sellers, but they sell great as like a pack together. But you have to be willing to fail to grow. And the beauty of entrepreneurship is if you keep failing, you become sort of inoculated to failure. You know it's going to be there, but it just stops hurting so much. And so you're able to like, you develop this sort of superhuman ability to like charge into battle again and again and again and again and again. And most of entrepreneurship, or most of success in life, is the ability to get up and charge back into battle when other people are failing and other people have stopped. I'm a writer, right? So like they say 1 in 2 Americans wants to write a book. And when I started, it felt almost impossible because there were so many people at the starting line.
Right.
But the more things that you can do down that entrepreneurial journey, the more distance you have, you start looking back and realizing, oh, there's nobody left. There's not enough people left. Like, and sort of you get a career by just your ability to persist.
Yep, you're right. Well, I have enjoyed this conversation so much. Thank you so much for sharing your failures and everything with us. I know you have to go, so I'm going to let you go. But if anybody wants to connect with you or go to your courses or anything like that, they can just go to your website at thecompletecreative.com. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I have free courses, epic blog posts, and more. And if you'd like to check out my writing work, if you like monstrous mythology and magic, you can head on over to russellnolte.com and sign up there.
You have been listening to the Teachable Soul podcast. You can find us on any social media platform, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram as The Teachable Soul, or on Twitter as Teachable Soul. Also, if you'd like to help support the show, you can find us at patreon.com/theteachablesoul. You can also visit our website for more information at theteachablesoul.com.